How many of you have seen the musical Oklahoma? Any of everybody. Well, not everybody, but it's a good one. And several times, yeah, well, and if you have, as I have seen it several times over the years, there's a phrase in the musical, the cowboys and the farmers. Yes. Yes. And this is the service medication as well, if you notice that. But it's also set up for disaster. It means that though cowboys and farmers, that they can be friends, inscrutable decisions and events in the world, they make for catastrophe. And the result is not friendship, but war. I bring up the musical because in a way it has some basis in the age-old story all about Cain and Abel. And it's a narrative, this narrative, about the first murder, and therefore the first biblical death. Pat McCurdy, this past week, wanted to know how she could connect the Sunday school lesson with the sermon. And she said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Murder." And she said, "Okay, we'll try something else, maybe. Just make sure the kids are..." I don't know at that age if you can understand some of this, but here it is. I'll read the long scripture. Thank you, Robin, for reading the other long one, but we'll get into it. Now, the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, "I have produced a man with the help of the Lord." Next, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel for his part brought of the firstlings of his flock their fatty portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let us go out to the field." And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield to you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me from the soil, and I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive, a wanderer on the earth, and anyone who meets me may kill me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. Whoever kills Cain will suffer a sevenfold vengeance." And the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who came upon him would kill him. And then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. So there is the happy story for today. Look over there. Go. The Hebrew word for Cain, by the way, it means to acquire. The Hebrew word for Abel means nothingness or futility. This seems interesting since Abel is the so-called victim in the story and Cain is the perpetrator. what does Cain acquire other than the reputation of a scoundrel willing to kill his own brother out of envy? And why is the Abel name characterized as futile or nothing? Something left out of the story, though briefly mentioned at its conclusion, is that Adam and Eve had another son named Seth. And according to the genealogy of the Bible, the bloodline of our inheritance doesn't come from either Cain or Abel, but from Seth. There's nothing remarkable, by the way, about Seth, other than he is the ancestor of Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, and eventually Jesus. We have been brought up on the idea that original sin comes from Adam, and yet the actual word sin is not used until the story of Cain and Abel, where for the first time God warns Cain, "Why are you angry and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door, its desire for you, and you must master it." So those of you who were here last week's sermon, it was about the story of Adam and Eve. And there's a sense that Adam and Eve were set up. God demands obedience, and for these curious creatures, God must already anticipate disobedience. After all, God is God. If God is surprised by their actions, how could God even be God? Can God create a rock too heavy for God to pick it up? What a conundrum. That's all about philosophy. There's written an ancient explanation for the origin of what in human nature leads to the host of deadly sins. It is called an etiological myth. John Barth says, "The story of Cain and Abel is an answer for us, much like the question, why does the fox have a white tail? Or the question, why doesn't the snake have legs?" It strikes me that if one just asks the question, how come we have these cities with arts and sciences where people go around killing each other? Well, the story of Cain and Abel, like the story of Adam and Eve in the garden, is one culture's attempt to give an account, not always very satisfactory, of these accidents of history. How do we account for hatred and war and the messes we create for one another? Well, it goes back to Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, of course. The temptation and disobedience of Adam and Eve lead to envy and conflict and contest, murder in the lives of their children. What is it that made Cain's offering insignificant to God? Abel gave the firstlings of his flock their fatty, beefy portions. As the story progresses, God smells the aroma of cooked meat, you know, kind of like when we do if we're driving by a restaurant in Cadillac or in Traverse City. You can smell it coming out of that wonderful restaurant. How does that compare to cooked broccoli? I mean, come on. God wants and therefore accepts meat. God does not want and therefore rejects vegetables. Is that fair? No, it's not fair. How does one like Cain offer the first vegetables? It doesn't work. Cain is the older brother. He's the farmer. He's rejected. Abel, the younger brother, the cowboy, he's accepted. The text doesn't explain God's specific food choices. Is God a meat eater or a vegetarian or a vegan? One may suggest that God does savor lamb over Brussels sprouts. And yet, why can't God accept both offerings, therefore laying out a balanced diet? In fact, let's add some gluten-free to the meal. No. God accepts the Abel meat offering and rejects the Cain vegetable offering. And there is a perfect setup for murder. I remember listening to my father at the dinner table speaking about one of his cases which took place in Chicago. You know, we would always talk about those cases at the dinner table. He had the task of entering an apartment there in Chicago to examine the handwriting on one of the walls, handwriting in blood. The blood was that of the victim, while the handwriting was that of the murderer. And the words on the wall said, "Please, somebody stop me from killing another one." Dad was given samples of the handwriting of several individuals who knew the victim and who possibly could have committed the crime. Why kill another human being? For money, for stuff like in Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, or for power as in Shakespeare's Macbeth, for jealousy, envy as in the story of Cain and Abel. Yeah, you better take the little one out. It's going to get worse. I know it sounds rather odd, but these were often our Dowd dinner conversations, and they actually help with digestion. Anyway, death enters the world for the first time through this murder, Cain killing his brother Abel. And so, like the explanation of disobeying God in the myth of Adam and Eve, there follows more disobedience in the story of their children. From early on, this Cain and Abel myth indicates that competition and envy, rivalries, evil, violence, and war are a part of human nature. But the story also reminds us that for any generation, including ours, we're all dealt different hands, some with a loser's hand and others with a winner's hand, some accepted, some rejected for no apparent reason. Out of no fault of anyone, some who work very hard will lose, and others who don't work at all will win. Why is that? Why is the world, the universe, so unfair? If this were the only lesson in the story of Cain and Abel, this piece of biblical material might not have been passed on. However, it's the follow-up narrative concerning the response to the rejected offering which makes for the long and lasting value of the myth of Cain and Abel. God says that when sin is lurking at Cain's door, it is up to Cain to master it. In the Jewish tradition, there's the notion of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, which is always there like a beast in the jungle of human life, waiting to pounce and attack the minds and the hearts of people who are struggling with rejection or depression or loss, jealousy, greed, power, whatever the struggle is. And the story says to me that envy, hatred, and the will to do harm are endemic in us, and often it is much easier to identify with the one who wrestles with these hard choices, who lives with the tension, who directly engages with passion, and who likewise may find oneself completely vulnerable. The futility embedded in Abel's name recognizes that so often goodness and purity and fidelity may not protect us. It did not protect the Jews from the Holocaust. It did not protect the Native Americans. It did not protect those in Africa sold into slavery. It did not protect the LGBT community. It did not protect people with physical and mental disabilities. For so many people, what makes it difficult for belief in God is how God stands by and allows the innocent to suffer. In the end, Abel is dead, and dead is dead. God doesn't bring Abel back to life. So here's a question regarding the myth of Cain and Abel. How can I align myself with this God who allows the innocent to be punished or to die for no apparent reason? And a response to that question may first be a reminder that there is good in us and bad in us, and that we can either muster the will to do good and to be constructive in life despite the unfairness of the cards we're dealt, or we can harness our being to do evil and to be destructive in life because of the unfairness and meanness and meaninglessness of everything. The choice is ours. Well, in the end of the narrative of Cain and Abel, the Lord asks Cain where his brother is. Cain responds famously, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" For one thing, Cain's reply is rhetorical, in that he reminds God that God is the real keeper of all brothers and sisters, and therefore it is much like Adam's statement to God when he blamed God for creating the woman who brought him into temptation. In other words, Cain is tossing that question right back at God, saying something like, why are you asking me what happened? You're God. You should know. Stop playing games with your human creations. This becomes the foundation of ethical behavior, though the answer for anyone reading Cain and Abel must be, of course I am my brother's keeper, my sister's keeper. Of course I am responsible for other people in the community, that I'm connected to this entire web of life. When I hurt, the community hurts. When I heal, the community is healed. We need one another. Others are in need of us as well. So the story concludes with God banishing Cain from his land and his family to settle in the land of Nod. And Nod, by the way, that means to wander in Hebrew. There he is, east of Eden. And there in the land of Nod, Cain builds a city, which reemphasizes that indeed he is in exile because he is a farmer building a city. And Cain names the city after his son Enoch. So out of violence, envy, destruction, Cain begins his life all over again, much like Job, who began his life over again after terrible losses. Well, this weekend, as we heard with Jack and Linda, Margie, this wonderful African-American song, but we remember Martin Luther King Jr. And he once said, "Unearned suffering may be redemptive." King saw the unfairness of life, the arbitrary nature of suffering, arbitrary evil, which is a problem for us. And this text points to one solution that we can have in the face of violence and chaos. It is faith. And it is bearing witness to that faith because we believe that there is an organizing principle, a moral, though inscrutable force in this universe. And that faith is based on another level of existence, a place with God. Justice and fairness operate differently. And that's the point of this mark of Cain, the mark of Cain, which original sin may be understood as the inability to identify with the suffering of another person. And the mark of Cain may be understood to be a sign of one who inflicts that suffering on someone else. However, it should be advised for all of us that the mark of Cain was actually a mark of protection, like an armor. Cain's punishment, yes, it was alienation from the land and his family and God, but the mark God bestowed on Cain, it protected him from being avenged for the deed he had done. The mark of Cain eventually became this guiding principle for the Hebrew people, as opposed to Hammurabi's code, establishing a law where one life has to pay for another. The Jewish people founded this idea of an eye for an eye. You've heard of this, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But Faye Kellerman says this actually concerns a law referring to monetary compensation It is not to be taken literally. In other words, if you injure somebody's eye, you pay the difference between a person's work value with two eyes versus the work value of one eye. In fact, this method is how personal injury suits are settled today, for better or for worse. Therefore, it is not a law of vengeance. It is a law of rightful compensation, similar to what happens when Cain gets taken from the land and thrown into exile. See, his punishment is that he has to build cities. Yet this is the measure for measure justice. And it teaches lessons about God's mercy, which will override our sense of what is right and what is wrong. And finally, that's the tough question. What do we do with people who have done evil things? Banishment, life in prison, capital punishment, or let them go back into the world to commit another crime? What do we do with a Charles Manson? He's now sick at the age of 82, still in prison, still in roof. The jury, what did they just say? Death. In the books of Torah that follow Genesis, including Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, laws will establish sensible and practical foundations and traditions which will guide the behavior of the people of Israel. And much later, in countries around the world, more civil laws will eventually be created to measure out various forms of justice. I'll conclude with a couple stories. One from a book recommended by Rabbi Kushner, and the other a popular television series. Now, in the book Mr. Ives' Christmas, a man named Mr. Ives believes in goodness and yet watches his son get killed for no apparent reason. He asks himself how one can stand up to pointless suffering and death and even remain alive in this cruel world. At the end of the book, Mr. Ives, he makes a decision. He makes a choice for goodness, directing himself to help others, realizing that the world is still better off if he believes in love and forgiveness by doing acts of charity as a way of lifting up the memory of his son. The other story comes from a television series. I'm sure none of you have heard of this series. It's called All in the Family. Nobody knows that, right? It's off primetime, of course, but it's syndicated now, so yeah, you can still watch episodes. Most of us wonder about Edith Bunker and her capacity to love somebody like Archie in spite of all of his shortcomings. In one episode, Archie discovers that in their card games over the years, Edith has been letting him win. And he gets really angry and he says, "That's all right, Edith the Good. You'll stoop to anything to be good. You never yell. You never swear. You never make nobody mad. You think it's easy living with a saint? Even when you cheat. Do you cheat to win? No, you don't cheat to win. You cheat to lose. Edith, you ain't even human." She responds, "That's a terrible thing to say, Archie Bunker. I am just as human as you are." And Archie says, "Oh yeah? Then prove you're just as human as me. Do something rotten. Do it now. Do something really, really rotten." Well, of course, Edith is sensitive and caring about people. And Archie concludes with a rather surprising quality of respect, and he says this: "The world ain't ready for you, Edith. What I'm trying to say, Edith, is that I know you never stole nothing, and you ain't never lied to nobody, and I'm sure you ain't never hurt nobody. The world just ain't ready for you, Edith." The real tough questions will remain as first spoken by Cain in that early story about brotherhood and murder. Am I my brother's keeper? How do we respond in a world where my brother or sister is the murderer or the victim? And where is my responsibility in all of it? As Viktor Frankl says, not where does the tragedy come from, but where does it lead? God's justice says that if we are to bear witness to our faith and to the mystery and substance of all that speaks to that faith, compassion and mercy and love and community, then the answer must always be, yes, I have a responsibility to do all the good I can. In these stories, how do you see yourselves? Are you Cain? Are you Abel? Are you Mr. Ives? Are you Archie? Or are you Edith? And is the world ready for you? Amen.